Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kyla Tsinis.
Kayla Itsinis. I'm Kayla Itsinis, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello and welcome to episode 163 of the world's first Paul Weller fan podcast. I'm Dan Jennings, and 10 years ago, I gave up my life's dream and career as a radio presenter with one big regret. Never getting to interview my hero, the legendary singer, songwriter, and musician, Paul Weller. This podcast exists purely to solve that issue. Welcome to Desperately Seeking Paul. And on this episode of the podcast, I'm joined by a young man with a passion for music. The hugely talented Billy Sullivan is my special guest. We're going to take a journey from his love of music as a kid through to the formation of the Spitfires in 2012, building a cult fan base on their own terms through hundreds of highly energetic and powerful live performances and five brilliant studio albums. We'll talk tracks recorded at Black Barn Studios, Paul Weller HQ, supporting Mr. Weller on tour as well. We'll talk about Billy's love of the music, the jam, the Style Council, Paul Weller solo, and Paul's influence on his songwriting. We'll also chat through his outstanding solo debut album, Paper Dreams, which arrived in March this year. Recorded in just 3 days in Liverpool and produced by one-time Paul Weller collaborator, Simon Dine. Another really special episode. Let's get into it. Billy Sullivan, thanks for joining me.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I've loved your music for quite a while with the Spitfires. We'll talk about the solo projects and Paper Dreams and all that and where you are right now. But it's lovely to have you on, man. So thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you.
Obviously, we're going to talk about life as a singer. So, I mean, you're a young man. I say life, but this has been such a huge part of your life for quite a number of years. But your life as a singer, songwriter, musician. And of course, we'll talk about this love of Weller. And because it's fair to say he's been an influence, right?
Yeah, he's definitely been an influence. Ever since I was a kid, he's definitely been an influence. I have to be careful, though, because it's so much of a focus on me is that I'm a Paul Weller fan and it sort of takes over. No one bothers listening after a while. So it's like I'm like a closet Weller fan these days.
Oh, really? It's strange that though, isn't it? Because I think as a singer, as a songwriter, musician, you get kind of badged with something that just then sticks and it's hard to shake off, right?
Yeah. When my first album came out, I was 21 or whatever, and that's obviously what I wanted to portray as a person, and we were this sort of band or whatever. But you realise pretty soon that once you get that stuck on you, it's very, very hard to shake off. But again, I don't let it affect what I'm into or what I look like or what I'm doing. A bit older now, so I don't have to preach about it, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but it's that thing, I think, and I had Purple Hearts on the other week, and we were talking about the fact that they're a band who happen to love mod, but they just get badged with it's a mod band. And I think there's that thing where if you listen to like Plays for Today and stuff, that's so far removed from where you were as a 21-year-old creating music, right?
Yeah, 100%. For me, it's like, yeah, the last two Spitfires albums were sort of where it was happening and where it was progressing. And I think, yeah, it's a million miles away from what we were doing. But bearing in mind, it was only like 6 or 7 years since the first one. So we progressed in a short space of time. But like we do as humans, you know what I mean? No one's the same. There's a massive gap between being like 20, 21 and then being like 26, 27, 28. There's a massive gap. You grow up loads and you experience things that, you know, change your life. And the music followed that. But I think with the Spitfires, it was just that heavy, you are this from day one, you're going to be this sort of band. We expect these sort of things for you. We expect you to have these sort of fans. And after a while, people just stop listening, regardless of what it's sounding like and where it's going, because you've already got that label.
The evolution, and I'm going to link it to the jam, because the evolution from those albums feels like that from In the City right through to The Gift. In the same way that Paul was developing his sound, discovering new influences, new things and stuff. You've definitely been that way yourself, right? You're kind of somebody who's always looking at the next thing.
Definitely, and I think it's the same for any band. If you're together for that amount of time, and you know, you're growing up together or whatever, then you do have to keep pushing it. I wouldn't see any point in just like wanting to do one thing and stay doing that. I wouldn't get anything from that. The buzz I get off of is knowing that I'm progressing and I'm getting better as a songwriter and I'm trying different things. And as long as I feel like I'm doing that, then I feel like I'm succeeding in what I'm doing. As soon as I stop feeling like I'm doing that and feel like I'm treading on ground or whatever, then I'd kick it, you know, kick it in the head, but to be honest. So just like,
yeah, or blow it up, I guess.
Yeah.
You've kind of done to a certain extent with this as well. So let's throw it away and start again. And we'll talk about the solo career and where you are right now. So let's talk Weller. How did you discover Weller? Was it the Jam or was it the solo years?
So I was born in 1994, and my dad was, and my mum to some extent, with Paul Weller fans. And I just remember his music in the house constantly. For some reason, at a really early age, I'd say about 3 or 4, I started to take a real interest in it already. My mum swears there's videos of me with a plastic guitar and my arm into Changing Man. And I used to apparently just stand and stare at the telly where my dad would play these old videotapes of, you know, clips of Weller and Oasis that he'd recorded off the TV. And I'd stand there just mesmerised and copy everything from the actions to, you know, the way they were playing the guitar, the way they were walking, everything like that. So it started from a really young age. And then when I was about 8, I'd say, I sort of went to school and all the other kids were into football, and I tried that a bit, but I was always shit at football. And I was sort of, when I was about 8, I something sparked something where I sort of spoke to my dad about the Jam, and he passed me the Direction Reaction Creation box set. That just become my whole world, that box set. I just become so engulfed in it all and, you know, started everything off for me, really.
And that's, I mean, that was how young my eldest is, 9. That's such a young age. I mean, he loves a bit of Ed Sheeran, to be fair, but he's not digging into it in that same way. That takes over your life then, presumably.
No, I obviously had this obsessive thing in my head, you know, which that just like, it just sort of clicked for me. It just made sense. It was like all the other kids were into other stuff, and this box set I had just sort of summed up what I was into and spurred me on to different things and reading more in depth about it. And, you know, other bands at that time as well. And because my dad had, you know, all these albums or whatever, I was able to just dip into it and just go, right, I've read something where someone mentions this record and I'd go and find it. If not, I'd, you know, try and get hold of it or whatever. I'd just becoming, immersed in the whole thing. And I straight away, at the age of 8 as well, I started learning to play guitar. And I decided the minute I picked up guitar that I just wanted to be in a band and nothing else mattered really. Which, to my parents' delight, obviously being at school or whatever, I'm suddenly going, no, I don't need to learn this. I'm going to be in a band.
Yeah. Sod the education. I'm
off.
Yeah,
look, I don't need to learn geography, mate. You know what I mean? Someone's going to drive me around in a tour bus. So I don't need to know where I'm going.
How long did it take before you were decent and could play a tune?
It was very quickly, really. So what I started learning when I was 8, and it was like classical guitar and grades and all that, and I really weren't interested in that. And I think for Christmas, my mum and dad bought me a Jam cool book, and I took it into my music teacher. I was like, I don't want to be doing all this, you know, you sit with the guitar in the middle of your legs, and I don't want to be doing all this, I want to learn this. And luckily, my guitar teacher was a Jam fan. So he was delighted, really, that a student had brought in something that, you know, he'd want to do. So I think the first one was Strangetown. I think he taught me on guitar. And the thing is with anything like that is that I learned bar chords for the first time. And once I learned bar chords, I was like, oh, I know guitar now. I don't need to learn anything else. And sacked in the lessons and sacked in. I'd never done any grades. I never learned to read music or do anything like that. I was like, well, I can play bar chords and I can play a couple of Jam songs. And, you know, I remember Ever Falling in Love by the Buzzcocks. I could do that. So I don't need to be taught anything else. I was like, I've got it from here, mate. I'm like,
do you regret that? Do you wish you carried on?
No, not at all. I mean, you get some people that are like musicians and they study their instrument and stuff like that. But mine was that I wanted to be in a band and I wanted to play guitar so that I could then be in a band. And I wanted to know how to play guitar enough so I could write my own songs eventually. And that's all it was for me. And everything else I learned after, like when I was younger, I'm going to talk about standing mesmerized by the telly. Most of what I can play on guitar, I learned from watching on the telly more than anything. especially because I can't read music and I don't really write music down either, only lyrics. So yeah, it's just, I don't regret that at all. Sort of, I'm not the most complex, accomplished musician in the world, but I could sort of give anyone a run for their money, I think.
It's such a young age to be thinking that way, but it's also like a confidence thing as well, of like, because you knew you wanted to be the front man, presumably.
I don't know, but first, like, we put together, like, there was like an end of year concert at primary school, and me and a couple of the other lads in my class who had also been learning instruments put together like a little band to perform at the end. I think at that point, I had no intention of singing. I just wanted to play guitar in front of people, really. I started writing songs ridiculously young. I mean, nothing impressive, don't get me wrong. But when I was about 10 or 11, I started writing things down or trying to copy other people's songs and make my own or whatever. But as soon as I started doing that, I was like, I ain't giving this to anyone else to sing. No way in the world. And for some reason, I had the bottle to just be able to go and do it and just get up there and do it, even from, 10 or 11. We used to do stuff like, they used to do like open mic nights at, open mic afternoons at pubs around Watford and Coxey and Rycett and the surrounding areas or whatever. And there'd be these old blues musicians like in their 60s. And they'd have all the equipment, all the flash equipment, and they'd just do these 15-minute jams and anyone could write up. And we used to just go along because it was Sunday afternoon, we were allowed in the pub. So we just used to write our name down and go up and just play through all the equipment and play a couple of songs or whatever. And for some reason, I just naturally had this thing where it didn't faze me playing in front of people. I was just, I was going to do it. And the more I had in my head that the more I'd done it, the better I'd get it. And which is what I've stuck to my whole career, really.
And was that you, the outside of music? Were you kind of more an extrovert or were you somebody who was kind of introspective?
I don't know. My music is, the fact that I'm a musician or I'm a songwriter or whatever makes up most of my personality, I'd say. Other than that, I'm quite a quiet bloke who's, into clothes and going down the pub, really. And that's the sort of stretch of it. Being a musician sort of is my, and a songwriter especially, is my outlet to be a bit more interesting. Because as a normal bloke, if I weren't a musician, I'd be really, really boring. I mean, people struggle to talk to me as it is. I'm not the most chatty person in the world. But if they didn't ask me about how music was going, just would be fucked, you know what I mean?
You'd have to get out some kind of hobby, Philly.
I don't know, mate. It's like, except from what lager they're drinking or whatever, I don't honestly know. I'm not into football either. I used to be when I was younger, but and I like watching football, but I'm not into football. So I can't really even talk about that. Except for music, I'm quite hard work for most people, I think.
You mentioned fashion. The clothes comes from, I mean, that's obviously a huge big Weller thing, but that's something that you love, right?
Yeah, well, going back before, like, the Weller thing, I was, my other, like, sort of first love of music was the Beatles, and I was obsessed with anything to do with the 60s, like, anything. So, when I was younger, for Christmas and stuff, I used to ask for books, just any sort of picture books, whether it be the Beatles or the 60s thing. I was always obsessed with the way they looked, and I sort of made the connection with Weller and the jam box that I was doing. And again, that became a massive focus for me. Again, I've always been, I must have been a really strange kid because, like, my mum talks about it now. Like, she told me that I once had a tantrum because she put a shirt on me to go to a christening when I was really young. And I didn't like the cut of it. I thought the sleeves were too long. And I threw a tantrum over it because I didn't want to wear it. And what kid does that? Not because I didn't want to go to christening, just because, the sleeves are too long, I can't wear this.
Yeah, yeah. I look like a right muppet. Yeah. Now, you talk about picking up the guitar and writing words, and obviously you're getting better and better, but the formation, was the Spitfires the first proper band?
Yeah, I mean, the lineup changed many times, but I had the name from when I was about 10 or 11. It's like, I sort of decided my head, right, I'm going to be in a band, it's going to be called the Spitfires, and I sort of went through various stages of trying to find people that were going to do it. And I didn't find the lineup everyone now knows as the Spitfires, the three of us, me, Matt and Sam. We didn't meet until we were 17, 18. So it was, I had all those years of chopping and changing and trying to work out what I was doing and learning more about it. And then, I met Matt and Sam. Our first gig was my 80th birthday. So,
and it's fair to say, I mean, you grow literally, it grows from nothing to this really big following and lots of critics are talking about it and stuff. And your first couple of singles, let's talk about the first couple of singles because they were recorded at Weller HQ at Black Barn, weren't they?
They were, yeah. So there was like three singles that we brought out, which again were only, it was only really small time then. We were still learning all about it. And, you know, they come up, we made CDs ourselves of them and used to flog them at gigs. And apparently they're worth a lot of money now, but God knows why. I mean, we used to stand in a line at our manager Stuart's mates, Reese, had a sort of lock-up gaff in Rickmansworth where he used to do printing. We all stood in a line and folded them all together and put them in and passed them around. And the first 500 we'd done of the first single all had the tracks the wrong way round. And then we'd done one single that wouldn't play on every CD player.
It's going well, yeah.
Yeah, and we're just like, yeah, just learning how to do it. But yeah, they were done at Black Bond, and I remember the first time we went in there, I was booked to go in there actually with, just as I met Matt and Sam, about a week after our first gig. The lineup I'd had as a band, I decided to get rid of everyone very quickly, and currently had the session booked to Black Bond but no band. And Sam was my mate that I'd met who had never played bass before, but he was just into the same sort of thing. So I was like, just go and buy a bass. Like, and the next day he bought a bass. And so he'd only been playing bass for 3 weeks before we went and recorded it. Matt had never played in a band before either. He'd just sort of been used to playing drums on his own. So we done one gig and then went into a Weller studio and just sort of completely and utterly blagged it.
That's amazing. So how does that connection come about?
God. So we're talking 10 years ago now. I'm trying to think. I think it was through Mark Baxter at the time. I think Mark Baxter, if my memory serves right, Mark had sorted the session out for us. You know, I was just over the moon to go in there.
And Charles Reese, so Paul's engineer, producer, produces the tracks. This is a man who's been involved with Mr. Weller for over 20 years now.
Yeah, I love Charles. He's such a nice fella. And the fact is as well, you've got to remember, like, he was sort of forced in this session where he didn't really know anything about us. We were just kids who couldn't play. And he sort of had to sit there and sort of, whilst Sam was still learning the bass part and things like that, and try and make something good out of what he had. And he worked really well with us. There was a track called Spark the Start, which ended up being on the first Spitfires album, which I sort of had. And he sort of saw like some good elements in it, but he sort of turned it on his head, really. And, you know, gave it this sort of, almost like sort of punky reggae dub sort of feel to it, which I'd never thought of. And really pursued. And it was like, when we got the recordings back, we're like, you know, this is the first time we've heard the band sound actually half decent from a recording. So we're really happy with it.
That must have been a real buzz to suddenly, you're hearing your music, but it sounds like a proper band, even though you've only been together for a few weeks.
Yeah. I mean, like up until then, I was only used to like, you'd pay the local rehearsal room to do a demo, which you do in 3 hours. Like, you just set up and then record you, and 3 hours, they spend 15 minutes mixing it, and you get it back and go, oh, fucking hell, that's awful. and it was the first time we got to that back, and we're like, oh, you know, that sounds really good. And it just shows that, you know, all we needed was someone who had a bit of experience and was able to sort of look at it and look at the song and sort of go, well, you know, that could work, actually, if you've done this to it. But apologies, so it's massively eye-opening. And I just loved being in the studio, you know, my first taste of it properly, but I loved just the workings of it and how we'd gone from where we started to what we were hearing at the end of the session. And yeah, it was a massive learning curve for me. It's the start of me wanting to, or learning how to really push things in the studio.
I mentioned to Charles that you were coming on. He said a couple of things. He said, hi, say hi to Billy for me. He said, I remember the guys being so enthusiastic. He said, I think one of the tunes twisted into a fast dub bass line. That was the one that you mentioned. But he said also how hardworking you were. And I guess that's the point with, like, you knew this was an opportunity and you didn't want to waste it, right?
Yeah, I was so... Even then, I was so confident that this is what I wanted to do. And I mean, people still say it now. It's like, a whole thing with the Spitfires is that we were far too serious. Everyone thinks we were far too serious or whatever. But I take what I do very seriously. This ain't just a hobby that I do. That I take songwriting incredibly seriously. And even then, probably more so because I was very highly strung at that age. You know, still am a little bit, but far more then. So I took everything very seriously. It was like, no, we are here to work. Like, we are here to work. And I believe that, you know, you get results out of working hard at things and trying different things. And so, yeah, even then, I can imagine that I would have been the one who was like, right, no lunch breaks, nothing, trying to keep Charles there as late as possible. I'm still like it now. I'm still murdered for it. Still trying, like, you know, the engineer hasn't been home for 2 days. And I'm still going, right, now come on, right, just have a beer, right? And, you know, relax for 10 minutes and we'll get back to it.
Let's talk live performance. So you start gigging more and more. You're getting tighter as a band. Your songwriting is developing as well. And actually, I should ask you, first of all, in terms of as a gig-going punter.
Yeah.
First gig was Weller, is that right?
Yeah. When I was, I think it was 10, I think it was 2004, or I would have been 9. I don't know. I can't remember what month it was. It was at Hammersmith Apollo. I remember that. I think it was in between Studio 150 and As Is Now. It was about that time, I think.
Okay.
But yeah, my mum and dad, even as, you know, a young kid, I remember my mum and dad going to see Weller with their friends. Yeah, when I got to 8, I was allowed to go. But I was only allowed to go in the seating section upstairs. I wasn't allowed to go downstairs.
So you can see all this fun happening downstairs in the mosh pit and all that, right?
Yeah, and I remember I had a Ben Sherman shirt. Right? Ben Sherman had done a Beatles collaboration, and I had a Ben Sherman shirt on that had all the heads from the Hard Day's Night photo strips. I remember I wore that. I was amazed that I'd seen, like, mods for the first time. Sort of people that were wearing clothes or sort of seen in books and on telly or whatever. As an 8, 9, 10 year old would imagine that I would then wear, you know, when eventually, you know, I could fucking fit into it. And being blown away by that. I remember the first track being a Weaver for some reason.
So the lineup then would have been, so you had Steve Craddock, you had Damon Minchella would have been bass, yeah, right? Yeah, Steve White, obviously on drums. Seamus Fagan on keys. Yeah.
It might have been, yeah. Can't really remember.
And you might have even had Jacko Peake back at that time. I'm trying to think, because he was back in the band at that point, I think, for a little bit. But and then obviously back now. So let's flip it then. So you now being on stage, you're now a gigging musician. It's a very different thing being in a band. I mean, so much of it's about the live performance versus making records. Do you have a preference from being in the studio to being on stage?
No, I just see them as different, two different things, really. Live performance is like... For me, it's like, it's a necessary in my life to do live performance. I have to be playing. If I don't play for long periods of time, I become so irritable and hard to be around. Because it's my only outlet in, you know, for me anyway. It's like my life as a whole is pretty much sort of hanging around until I go on stage, which sounds quite depressing, but it's not. It feels like that sometimes. They start today when I'm playing tomorrow. It's just like I'm literally just hanging about, just waiting to go on stage.
And then what are you like when it's done?
When it's done, I don't know, there's all these cliches that you're on cloud nine and you're riding high or whatever. And it's not like that. It's just like I get so worked up before going on stage that I spend the first 10 minutes after I've come off pacing the room, the dressing room, up and down, up and down, up and down, trying to wear off. And then I can't sleep at all. We used to go on, when we were on tour or whatever, I'd be the only one who didn't sleep. We drove back from Glasgow one night years ago. We drove to the gig, which took 12 hours because of the traffic. Done the gig. We were in Glasgow 3 hours and then drove home for the night. And I was the only one, and I, you know, I was awake the whole time, and I was the one who had to keep the driver awake as well, obviously. Sort of just prodding him every now and then. Playing the pistols really loud at 3 o'clock in the morning, trying to wake him up. But I don't know, it's such a weird thing. People say they can sum it up, they're lying, really. It's such a weird thing to sort of do and be into. But it's an absolutely necessary in my life. I'd go insane if I couldn't play live.
Let's talk about some of these gigs around the Weller connection as well, because supporting Weller came pretty early on, didn't it?
Yeah. I was working around Marrowbone and we saw Weller pull up and go into a Costa Coffee, and I followed him in and sort of just like, didn't really know what to say then. I would have been about 19, 20, I think. He sort of could see that I was awkwardly standing in the queue, sort of looking at him, think like, you could probably see my brain going, what do I say? So he sort of said, hello, mate. I was like, and I said something about his jacket. I said, like, I like your jacket. And he went, yeah, it's nice, isn't it? And anyway, I said, I'm in a band called the Spitfires. We've used Blackburn before. It's like, thank you for letting us use it. And he's like, oh, nice one. And then he sort of went and sat down and was having a coffee. And he come back a couple of minutes later, come back to me and went, we should do some gigs together, a couple of gigs together in the future. I said, obviously, I'd love that. And that was it. And that's all we said. And then 2 months later, we got an email. We couldn't believe that one of the gigs was in Watford. Because at that, especially at that time, no one played Watford. Got one venue, Watford Coliseum, and it never gets used. And it was used for a small, brief period of time, about 5-10 years ago. They used it for people like, well, I think Noel come once, saw Noel there, and various other people, and now it's gone back to not having anyone on. But it was just like, we couldn't believe the luck, like the fact it was our hometown as well.
That must be such a buzz. I was talking to the Stone Foundation about that similar thing whereby they were playing with Weller on the tour and it came back home. Because it's like that stamp of approval in a way, isn't it? And it's in front of your, presumably like your mates, your old schoolmates or whatever. It's like, yeah, you know, we've arrived.
Yeah. It was a big deal. We'd never played venues that big or stages that big. Again, it was another learning process because, you know, they're completely different doing them sort of shows than they are to doing, you know, small club shows or whatever we were used to at that point. And still at that point, we were only having like, I don't know, 60, 70 people come to our gigs. And then we were put in front of like, I think Watford Coliseum holds 2,000, 2,500. And it weren't completely full, but it was pretty full because we were the local band. I remember Weller standing behind the amps while we were playing or whatever and watching us and sort of noticing. And then the next night, he come up in soundcheck and said, he goes, you lot got a good response, didn't you? I was like, yeah. He was like, did you have all your mum and dads there? Cheering me. Like, fucking hell. But yeah, it was a great experience. I mean, I've always regretted it in one way because it was a year too early for the Spitfires, really, I think. My nerves got the better of me, so I didn't really enjoy it. And the band were, we just finished recording our first album, I think, anyway, or we just finished mixing it or something. You know, it was still really early days. And it was sort of like, yeah, so it would have been 5 months before Response was released, before we'd sold out any shows ourselves, before we'd sort of really got into, you know, what we're about to become. So that's my only regret. And, you know, just a naivety of it all. Would have changed the space a bit. You know what I mean?
It's that thing though, isn't it? It's like, you know, you're looking back, it's like, were you ready at that stage? And if your album's not even out, most people are not knowing the music either.
No, but it was a weird thing with the Spitfires. Like everyone sort of, the name was out there. And again, because, you know, it's like what I spoke about earlier, because of the imagery of the band early on and the way we look, we stuck out a bit and, you know, people are very curious about us. I think as well, because, you know, I might stand out of line here, but up until that point, there were so many bands in a similar sort of vein who were so shit and so ordinary, and they loved the mod theme because it gave them an audience rather than used it to influence their music, if you get what I mean. It was just like, it was becoming a member of a club. Like, we're in the club now, so can you come see us regardless if we're good or not? And I think the Spitfires were different because we actually had something about us and we had, you know, a few decent songs and we were really good live and good musicians, which sort of made people spend time to listen to us at first and sort of get into it. I think, you know, we were quite different to the rest of the mod bands at that time.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Clearly, Billy, I mean, you won't say this, but I will say it for you. You know, clearly there's talent there in terms of the songwriting, right? And by that point, you're 10 years in, aren't you? From an 8-year old to then writing songs. We're now 20 years in, right? Yeah. And, you know, the more you spend on something and you love it and you've got that passion, you're going to get better at it. And the Spitfires was what, 10 years of your life, wasn't it?
Yeah, 10 years of my life. Yeah, doing it properly. It was like, it was, you know, it was 10 years of my life, but it was like, you know, I lived and breathed every second of it, right? It was, you know, we weren't just a band in my head. We were like one of the important bands. We were going to be one of the important, we were going to be like the Jam or the Clash or the Specials. And it was like this gang mentality and like a uniform. And we were a very close knit group. The only plan was to write amazing songs and take over the world. That was the only plan, and nothing would get in the way of that for me. And yeah, it was just, you know, it was a massive part of my life. Can't play it down.
It's such an interesting time for the music industry, though, because I think the time that you're hitting, everything's flipped upside down completely in terms of that record label system. We're into Spotify and streaming rather than releases, all that kind of stuff. There's no guidebook to take you through this and how to make this work, is there? And sometimes that kind of old model of just gigging and releasing that's not really how it works anymore as much, is it?
No, I think, you know, I'm a strong believer in that no one knows what they're doing. No one. Like the industry don't, they sort of make out they do, but something can come along very quickly and change everything again. But there's so much bullshit involved, there's so much politics, and, you know, especially when you get into the label side and the business side of it. My thing was always that if my songs were strong enough, they would get through to people regardless. I always believed that if the songs were good, then people would eventually hear them. So that's what I stuck to. You know, I stuck to trying to write great songs, but evidently the label side of it does take over at one point and, you know, can quite easily leave you in the wilderness because you don't know what to do. You know what I mean?
Well, there must be an element of you kind of going, God, it shouldn't be this hard, because it felt like you had to constantly battle against these different things and fight and fight and fight and prove yourself again and again and again.
I don't know any different, to be honest. It's like, you know, that's just the way it always has been. And, you know, I've always had to fight for what I believe in, and that I believe the songs are good and how the band should be represented. And, you know, I fought every step of the way with anyone as well, even if it's, you know, manager, band members, you know, I've fought for exactly what I think is right. And, you know, I still stand by every sort of decision that I ever made within the band, except from the imagery thing. But the imagery thing was a naive thing that 2021, who I was, so can't really say too much against it.
No, it's also, I mean, that was then, that was you, that was the authentic you at that moment in time. And there was another Weller support slot as well later, so this is 2019, the summer, Cornwall.
Yeah, that was really good. That was really good, actually. It was like, it was a big outdoor gig, but it was like two stages. The Zombies were on the bill as well, which we were really impressed with. We'd just come out of the studio the day before of recording Life Worth Living, and we'd gone down to Cornwall and the band were buzzing. But then we were disappointed because at that point, the band were doing really, were like years later, Better Songs, Tighter Unit or whatever. And we were on a different stage to the main one. So I don't think anyone watched this or took much notice, to be honest. But it was good. It was good. And we had a right laugh afterwards. We just stayed and got really pissed. Remember we were backstage and there was sort of counter. We could go and order a beer and food, and we went up and ordered beer and food, and we worked out it was free. So everyone started ordering by the crate loads. Then someone ordered 10 pizzas, which all got eaten and drunk. And then we just sort of ran right. I mean, backstage there as well, it was like this little courtyard and there was all the bands sort of there. And it's a bit like a circus. There's dogs running around, kids running around, there's sort of music blaring out of dressing rooms, lots of people running about everywhere. Seem to remember Weller hanging off like a, I can't remember, they were like little, almost like little chalets, the dressing rooms. And he was hanging off a wooden beam, pulling himself up and down.
Doing pull-ups.
Yeah. And I just remember thinking, this is a bit surreal. Like, that was a good gig. That was a good gig.
There's a lot of love for the band. Let's talk about the final album and we'll talk about the solo stuff because I really want to cover a lot of that, right? That final album came on the Friday. play for today, and then the final gig on the Saturday, and then done. Was it Sunday, I'm a solo artist? Was that what was in your head?
Oh, I was a solo artist 2 months beforehand. I'd already recorded Paper Dreams in early February, so the first week or whatever, and then we had the last album, the last gig at the end of that month, and then I had my first gig as a solo artist in the April. So it was already done and dusted, really, then. But that last album was... So it was written and recorded in the first lockdown. We just couldn't come to any sort of agreement with our label about anything at all. And the album got dragged out. It got mixed countless times to the point where the process slowed down so much that there was no momentum behind it at all. I strongly believe that if the Spitfires had stayed together and we hadn't done that last gig, we would have done a tour, a play for today, that still would have been half empty. You know, it wouldn't have been held in some high regard, because the album was always set up to fail, in my opinion, because it was misunderstood.
Andy McDonald was on the podcast the other week, Go Discs Independiente, and he was talking about the job of a label, that support that obviously Paul had come out of the thing with Polydor where they rejected the Style Council's last album, is into the Go Discs. And the fact that you lose a bit of the belief when that happens. And you can tell that in Paul's obviously first couple of solo albums, there's the self-doubt and stuff like that. Yeah, you need the support of a label. You need the support of a label boss to feel like they believe in the band and they're going to take it forward. And when you don't get that, that must affect you mentally, right?
100%, 100%. Anything I'm doing, I'm so sure of, you know, I was so sure of that album and the progression it was making and the lyrics and the overall concept and the sound of it. I was so sure of it. And then to have basically be told that we don't understand this at all. This is going to alienate you from your audience. No one's going to get it. We've played it to people. No one else likes it. It's like, well, hold on a minute. Like, what am I doing wrong here? Fair play, though, I stood up and I went, no, I think this is really good, actually. I'm going to stick to my guns on this. And I did, and I saw it through to the end as best as I could. You said it yourself earlier, you're constantly having to prove yourself in music anyway, and you feel like everything's going against you. And then the people in your own team then are going against you. We had band members leave, we had management leave, and it was like me on my own sorting absolutely everything, you know, at that time. I had help from Simon Dine, who was advising me and helping me, because again, it's a labour of love for him as well. And we've created this album that we both thought was really good, and we both thought would have a massive opportunity to get the band out to more people. And in the end, it just got too much. What am I fighting for here? Even if I fight it through to the end, everyone around me is sort of pissed off now. So, it doesn't matter. It's just going to be me on my own anyway.
Yeah, so let's move on to the next thing. Let's talk about Simon, because obviously there's the Weller connection there as well. First of all, would have been Illumination. They did It's Written in the Stars. And then we had 22 Dreams, played a big role on Wake Up the Nation, Sonic Kicks as well. So how did you connect with Simon in the first place?
I think that was Gary Crowley who...
legend. Did he see something in the fact that you could work together or bringing you together?
Perhaps. I can't quite remember the connection. All I remember is that there was a sort of discussion about it, and I said I'd love to because I always loved 22 Dreams. And that was it, really. I'd never worked with a producer before or anything like that. And the way he worked was completely different to how I worked. And I'd sort of had to blag it as I went along and pretend I knew, you know.
In what way? What does he bring to the party in that way?
Well, he's a very, very creative producer. Most producers will take what you've done and sort of mould it into something or whatever. But Simon is right at the heart of the creative process and the writing process. You know, he's not just my producer, but he's a co-writer. We write songs together. It's just a very different experience working with someone like that. Especially because it was so precious, you know, beforehand. It was like, I remember once that Sam Long spoke about writing a song once, and I just glared at him, like, just put that to bed straight away. Like, not
happening. That's like if Rick Buckler ever mentioned it in the jams. Like, no, it's not happening, Rick.
Yeah. I just sort of looked at him, like, bewildered. Like, why would you even bring that up? Like, which was, you know, a silly thing to do, but you know, I was 17, 18 and thought, I am the songwriter, that will be my job, no one else's.
Yeah, yeah.
But then when someone comes along that you can collaborate with, like I did with Simon, you create different things, and he takes the best elements of my writing and pushes them far beyond probably what I could achieve on my own. Got to be a good thing.
Well, let's talk Paper Dreams. So this was the album, the first solo album of many, yeah. I'm sure. This is your name above the door, right? Billy Sullivan now. We're not hiding now, man. Yeah. We're out there. But a really quick album to make. Was it like 3 days?
3 days in a studio in Liverpool. Just me, Simon, and you and the drummer in the studio. And we just cracked it out, basically. We'd had the songs about 5 months or something like that. So we knew exactly what we're doing. Me and Simon had worked together on the last 2 Spitfires albums, so we knew exactly how to work, how to get the best out of each other. And we, you know, there's a no-nonsense thing, really. We just crack on. It's like there's no point dwelling over things. We know how to work. So it was very quick. Since Life Worth Living, every album's got shorter and shorter to make. My next one will probably take an afternoon. Be like, please me or something.
Bang, we're straight in, and it's just over half an hour. It's a really tight sound, and it's undoubtedly you. But again, it's an evolution. You're taking it forward.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted it to just be a no nonsense record. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, lyrically, it's a lot of finding my own sort of voice again, finding a bit of confidence again. It was like an unwritten thing that, you know, if the Spitfires broke up, I'd go solo. It's like, you know, what else am I going to do? But it was like, it's just having the confidence to, you know, because in my head it was like, well, I'm not going to go and just play like a couple of new songs and all the Spitfire stuff. That's not going to happen. So I had to write songs that I thought were strong enough to, in their own right, to be able to just play, and that be the thing that people come to gigs to watch, and that be the whole thing that people concentrated on. And I think it worked with that album, to be honest. I think it was like the first, like running out of time for me was like the first time I'd had a bit of that back in for quite a while. I wanted it to feel like being punched in the face. And I think it does, to be honest.
It's a brave thing to do that, though, as a, you know, solo artist, to kind of almost go, well, no, actually, this is blank sheet of paper now. This is, you know, when I'm out on the road, this is the new stuff. You know, obviously, it's a Paul Weller podcast, so I'm going to say it, but there's a Weller model there, isn't there, of the fact that, you know, he's done that so many times. He's gone, do you know what, this period, I'm not playing the Style Council, I'm not playing the Jam, it's just the Weller solo stuff. And then eventually embraces that back catalog, which I imagine you will do in, you know, 20 years' time when we're having this conversation. Eventually, you'll look back on that, I'm sure. But right now, it's all about the now, yeah,
it's just having that confidence in what you do. You know, if you believe the songs are good enough, then you don't have to rely on the old stuff. And for me, if I wanted to play a set mostly of Spitfires tracks, I would have kept the Spitfires together. It's as simple as that. And you know, I've got enough confidence in my new material to think that I don't need to rely on that. And you know, if I do want to play one or two, it's because I want to play them, and I've tried to narrow that down to album tracks that maybe weren't played before. And the odd thing, I'm sure the Spitfires could get back together tomorrow and announce a tour, you know, or a couple of gigs next year, and they'd sell out really quickly. But so what then? You know what I mean? How is it going to progress from then? Then we're going to make another album, and it's going to be different from what people liked the first time round. And then we're going to be back to playing half-empty venues. You know what I mean? It's like, in hindsight, these people will, you know, it's like the last Spitfires gig. It was like, you know, it was the biggest headline gig we'd ever done. Which was great, but it was also bittersweet, because it's like, you know, if it was like this every night, then maybe the band wouldn't be splitting up, because we'd have the support of the fans and know that we could do it regardless of what was going on in the background.
It does feel like you've drawn a line under that, though. And, you know, you should feel confidence in the songs. I mean, not just that, but also the production's lovely. We get, you know, there's strings on this album. There's a vulnerability in you as well in your writing. And you're constantly evolving as a songwriter as well. It feels like you've put more of you out there on this LP.
100%, yeah. And I think that comes from feeling a bit vulnerable and having a bit of loss, you know, a loss of confidence. But also just being a bit older and writing in a different way. The last 2 Spitfires albums had all been character-led, really. And this one was more personal and more about the situation I was in. I think people can hear that in the songs. And I think that's why people feel a sort of felt a connection to them straight away. They could see, you know, that I was singing about what was going on in my head, really.
And these songs take on a life of their own. When you start gigging and playing them live, you kind of find out what really works with an audience in that setting, what stands out and stuff. And you've always had this knack of writing these songs with these kind of, you know, these kind of sing-along anthems, if you like. Are there songs that for you really, you know, surprise you from that album where you go, actually, this works so well in a live arena?
All of them, really. I've been lucky as well because the band I've got surrounding me at the moment are fantastic. We're able to play the whole album from start to finish, which I've never been able to do before. The Spitfires, there was always the odd track that was just too stretching us too much, or we weren't capable of doing for various reasons. But now I can sort of play anything I want off that album and for it to sound good. And I've tried everything, you know, I've tried playing every single song on that album. Some work, some don't. Some, you know, I'm still at a position now, but people still don't, for some reason, people don't know what to expect of my gig. I still get that. It's only now, over a year on, people are starting to realise what they are to expect from my gig. You know, they still think they're going to get the Spitfire stuff, I think. And they still feel a bit uneasy and a bit like, I don't know, still trying to get their head around the fact that it's just me on my own now, which I find strange. It's like, you know, it's what it says on the tin, man. It's not art.
It feels like you're back in control, though, which I like. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, you're back in control of your music, your career, working really collaboratively with Simon, obviously. And the album came out in March. Presumably there's new stuff that you're working on all the time, the two of you, right?
Yeah. We were in the studio in July. There's the majority of the next record knocking about at the moment, being mixed or whatever, which again is a progression, taking it in a different direction, which I'm happy with. Quite a drastic move as well, which I'm really excited about, to be honest.
And as a songwriter, that the confidence is back.
Yeah.
Is the vulnerability still there? Is it that kind of, I don't want to say softer side, that sounds terrible, but you know what I mean? It's kind of that self-doubt's gone, right? Or has it?
It's still there a bit. I mean, I don't think, you know, until I get to the point I felt like I was at the end of the Spitfires, you know, or beyond that, then there's still going to be that sort of self-doubt and vulnerability to it. But, you know, as you said, the confidence has grown now. So it's like the new stuff is like, I'm back with vengeance, really. And I've got my bike back and, you know, I'm going to be really opinionated again, you know, but in an older, more articulate way, which I'm really happy about.
I was at an event last night with the launch of Neil Sheesby's book, Stone Foundation, who, you know, obviously you know those guys, lovely fellas. We were talking about the fact that there aren't really any bands, any artists around right now who are like railing against the society that we live in. And you were thought, if people are not railing against what's going on right now, when would they ever? Christ. Yeah. The angry young man hasn't gone away. You know, how you look at the world and what's going on has come through in your lyrics before. Is that something that you're kind of looking at as well?
Yeah, definitely. You know, the thing is, life in this country at this moment can be quite bleak for most people, I think. I think the music industry don't want that represented. They don't want that sort of music being played. They want it all to be happy and about what you can dream about. And, you know, all this music is escapism and all that, you know, drinking cocktails on the beach and all that bollocks. I feel like, because I've got my confidence back and because I feel like I'm more articulate than I've ever been when it comes to lyrics, I feel like I can afford to be fucked off about a few things and write about them in the correct way and write about them in a way that are interesting and that people can relate to. So that's where I'm at the moment. It's a really shit time. It feels like it. It feels like it's been masked by different things. But, you know, ultimately, it's a pretty bleak future ahead, I think, for a lot of people. I think that should be represented in music. All my favourite bands and all my favourite musicians have always reflected the times that they lived in a clever and intelligent way. You know, my thing's always been, if you can write a political pop song that someone could dance to, then you're there, really. Something like the lines of Malice or, you know, Rock the Casbah or Ghost Town, Happy Hour, anything like that. I think that's what I've always aimed for. And I think that's what I'll achieve on the next record, but who knows?
Yeah. Well, look, man, we look forward to hearing it when it comes. Have you got an idea of release? I'm guessing 2024.
Yeah, at some point next year, hopefully. You know what I mean? I'm sort of keeping it open at the moment.
Well, look, always brilliant live. The album's terrific as well, like I say. I think it's it's a terrific piece of work, but it also feels like it's the start of something and start of something very special in what's to come. So, man, I really look forward to seeing what this journey is like for you and the music that comes in the future, because I think it feels like we're only just getting started, man.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you.
I have two questions for you before you go. You're allowed one Paul Weller song for the rest of your life. It can be The Jam, The Style Council. We didn't talk about The Style Council, Christ. Was that a thing for you?
Yeah, 100%. I think anyone who's into Weller, you know, it's normally, yeah, it was about when I was 14, 15. I had my heavy Style Council period, you know, walking down Watford High Street in a beret, getting shouted at out of Van Winders. Charity wanker, I think it was. And the espadrilles and rolled up jeans. I've done a lot of it, you know, to be fair. And I loved it. I really did love it. It's a very, very stylish period for Weller. Again, a very articulate period, probably more articulate than Jam was, I think.
Those political lyrics wrapped up in a pop song that you just talked about. I mean, absolute master at that point, right?
Yeah, Walls Come Tumbling Down is a great, great example of that sort of thing. You know, political pop you can dance to. Sums up probably, well, from anyone I know who lived was around at that point, summed up the time. All I know is it sounds like what I see on documentaries or reading books and all that sort of thing.
And then more recently, where are you at with like things like On Sunset, Fat Pop, True Meanings and that? Any highlights there for you?
There's really good songs on all records, really. For me, like, you know, out of the last, I'd say that like this period of Weller's career, sort of 22 Dreams is a massive highlight. Then it would be Saturn's Pattern, I thought was a great record as well. And then I think there's been great bits on all albums since then.
Okay, those final two questions I mentioned. So you're allowed one Paul Weller song for the rest of your life. It can be The Jam. It can be The Style Council then. You're a fan, yeah. That's good. Or it can be solo. What are you going to go with?
Oh, that's hard. That's really hard. Cool.
I love how my guests always overthink this. It's brilliant.
It changes from day to day. If I woke up with the ump this morning, it'd be Private L. You know what I mean?
You didn't know good.
No, I feel all right today, so I don't know. All right, so at the moment, probably what I've been, I'd say, I don't know. It's not like my favourite of all time or anything, but for some reason, like, Time Passes has come to my head.
Oh, that's a terrific tune, yeah.
Yeah. Also, and again, Fifth Season has come to my head as well. But, you know, I don't know.
Did your folks have particular favours?
Yeah, I suppose they have.
Like when you were like 5, 6 year old, they're going like, this is the one you need to hear, son, look.
Well, like, it was, you know, at that point, it would have been like Standing Road, Every Soul, that sort of period. So they're the albums I vividly remember as a kid. My parents said, like, when I had a favourite album when I was, like, 3 or 4, I used to scribble all over the front cover to, you know, which they absolutely loved, you can imagine. We worked with Tony Briggs in the Spitfires, and I showed him, there was my mum and dad's copy of Moses Scholes, and I scribbled all over the front cover, all over his photo. I was like, this means I like it, Tom.
Your parents are like, that would be worth a fortune now. Those original copies without all that scribbling on. Or they might be worth more, I don't know. Depends how you look at it.
I suppose that's where Time Passes probably comes from. Or Out of the Sinking. Right, I'll go with Out of the Sinking.
Oh, good save. Yeah, well done. Love it. And then final question. So the purpose of this podcast is to meet lovely people like yourself and hear your stories, your connections with Weller, but really more than that, you know, your tales. The reason I created the podcast was to get an interview with Paul Weller that I never managed when I was a radio presenter. It was my one big regret from giving up my career as a radio presenter. So I've created a podcast to make it happen. If I get to interview Paul at some point, what should I ask him? What would you like to know?
Ask him if he could ask Gary Crowley to give me his suit from the Solid Bond video.
Has Crowley still got it?
Well, apparently somewhere. I've asked him for it a few times, but no luck there. But if Paul has a word, then maybe he'll finally give it over. He's not going to wear it now, is he? You know what I mean? He's going to gather dust in his wardrobe. I could start up Watford High Street in that. Look the bollocks.
You get the people shouting out the window again.
Yeah, probably.
Hey, man, this has been so lovely. Thank you so much for your time, Billy. Really appreciate
it. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for having me on. Thank you.
Well, my thanks once again to Billy Sullivan for joining me on the podcast. I have to say, I don't know that I've ever heard Billy open up in that way anywhere ever on interview. So really, really pleased that we could get him on the podcast. Open, honest, hugely engaging, and what a talent as well. Do check out that album, Paper Dreams. You'll find all the details in the show notes for this podcast. And I also dig into the back catalogue of the Spitfires as well. Just go online, paulwellerfanpodcast.com is my website. You can also head into my store, get our official merchandise. And if you fancy it, you can buy yourself a virtual coffee as well. Hello, Simon Clemens, who's done exactly that. Says, hi, Dan. Love your interesting guests who know more than me. Keep on keeping on, Dan. Enjoy your brew, Simon.
Hello to Roger Clark. Thank you to you for your virtual coffee. Hi, Sean Wilson. Hello, Sean. Thank you so much. Hello to Phil Baker. Giorgio Moroso, thank you to you for your virtual coffee. If you want to get involved, just go online, paulwellerfoundpodcast.com. You can also get in touch on X, formerly known as Twitter. It's at WellerFanPod, or on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. Just search for Paul Weller Fan Podcast. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
Kayla Itzinas. I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.